right, so good afternoon, everyone. Hope you had a nice lunch, and you're not too relaxed. Because if Butch's remarks, closing remarks, were utopian, then I'm kind of afraid mine might be burying you, but I'm hoping that it's actually planting seeds. So I'm going to do some clearing of the land, and then we plant some seeds for where we want to go. I am supposed to talk about investment, trade, and taxation. Not the most exciting of topics. And I'd like to basically go through each of them systematically, make some general remark, and then talk each of them systematically, what's involved, but also point the way forward, drawing on some of the activities of civil society engagement on these processes. Because I think it's very important that we recognize that most all of the topics that we've talked about here and in the last 2 weeks, with the exception of time use, I would say, there's been tremendous amount of activism over the last 10, 15 years by various civil society groups with different levels of expertise, drawing on the services of economists of different persuasion, including heterodox economists and some who may not want to bear the label of heterodox, but who find various disagreement with the neoliberal model, like flag, for instance, Donny Roderick. But in terms of people like Hajun Chang and Tom Paley and others who have been trying to make their academic work relevant to the movement in terms of offering translation and distillation of their research in a way that will be useful for advocacy positions. So there's tremendous amount of work going on all these issues, and especially in the two, three areas that I'm going to talk about. I want to step back a little bit, because when I was looking at my presentation, and I thought, if I were to give a formal presentation on this, I would actually think, well, is it, my talk would be globalization in crisis or globalization as crisis? Because I think before the crisis, we already saw three distinctive things that were going on that were endemic of crisis. The first was, of course, the shredding of old social contracts, both national and international. Domestically, in terms of the great emphasis on fiscal austerity, fiscal restraint, inflation targeting, and a whole set of policies focused around natural rates of unemployment and so forth. Internationally, the kind of concord or international social contracts that I would like to refer to was a social contract that was implicit in the GATT and in some of the IFI stuff around basic needs, around special and differential treatment in the concept of the trade agreement, where within the special and differential treatment provision, that was inside the GATT, there was a recognition that there was a developing reality that required that developing countries had the right to be able to use infant industry and various sort of protective device to promote their industry and to protect their industries, and didn't have to follow the stipulations on trade agreements that the developed countries followed. Now, all of that was eclipsed and degutted with the trade agreement of the Uruguay Round, which brought in a new social contract, which was a social contract based on the single undertaking. And the single undertaking, a principle that all countries were basically equal players, and everybody accepted all of the negotiated provisions as one. And the only recognition of the distinction between developing and developed country was the fact that the special and differential treatment provision was maintained but was degutted. So countries were given time frames. So developed country, you know, high income had 5 years, others had 10 years. But the whole set of embodiment of special differential treatment in terms of the right to infant industry, the right to protect, and so forth, was certainly taken out of that. So I think that would, for me, that would be one element. And for me, Niloufer, when you say that there's a consensus achieved around poverty and gender equality, I think you're right, but there's also at the same time another train, which is the liberalization train, which is completely anti-poverty and completely anti-gender equality. And that, so those two trains have been persisting on the same track. And now with the financial crisis and the food crisis have actually collapsed. And many of us have been arguing for a long time that, in particular, the trade agenda and the development agenda were headed towards a significant collapse. So my second point is that One of the other elements of the fact that the crisis exists before the crisis, so to speak, was the shrinking gains from trade, and that trade liberalization had long been associated before this period with rising inequality, increasing food security, and an impact on the fiscal space, which endangered social sector spending around poverty and gender equality. And if you look at some of the data, and I don't want to overwhelm you at this point with data, but if you take the Human Development Report as late as 2003, argued that if you took the data of 2003, 18 countries with population over 460 million had lower Human Development Index than they did in 1990. So in 2003, 18 developing countries had lower Human Development Index than they did in 1990. And that prompted UNDP to call that an unprecedented reversal. With respect to trade gains, part of the reason why the Doha agenda hasn't moved in a way that it had moved was the struggle over trade gains, and that developing countries had recognized by 2005 that there was no significant gains from trade for the majority of developing countries. The World Bank predicted $800 to $500 million gain from trade. By 1995, even its own research brought that figure down to $84 million, and 70% of that was going to the high-income company. When you disaggregate that, that led to about $57 per household in the north and about $5 per household per year in the low-income countries. So the vaunted gains from trade have long since disappeared, even before the financial crisis. A work by Ackerman, this is a World Bank study in 2005, argued that there was less than one penny benefit from agricultural liberalization for the South. And in subsequent work by Stiglitz and Charlton in 2004, argued that the trade liberalization brought loss of welfare to the South, that even if you eliminated domestic subsidies and export subsidies, you would find that there would be higher cost of imported food for net importing developing countries. And work by Herzl and Kessler showed that the Doha round, which was projected by the World Bank to be generating over $76 billion in trade, when you actually disaggregate and looked at the data, it came out to less than $3 per day for developed countries and less than a penny per day and less than $7 per day for the less than $3 per day, pardon me, for developing countries and less than $7 per day for the developed countries. And there's been significant work around that showing that the poverty reduction potential of trade liberalization actually meant that you were actually moving people, that even if you took the World Bank figure and you actually looked at it and disaggregated, because in fact there were some serious errors that were made in the calculation by Klein and others, that when you look at it, what it meant was, say, an average citizen who were living on $2 a day in Bangladesh would be moved to 2.03 cents, right? And similar figures for India. So it's minute, it's very, not even marginal change in the rate of poverty. So this trade liberalization agenda had crashed a long time ago, and the financial crisis has simply reinforced that. So let me move specifically to my third point, which is the argument that the pervasive liberalization consciousness that have been impacting the global economy, investment liberalization, financial liberalization, trade liberalization, and liberal tax regimes were not anti-poverty friendly or gender equality friendly. But before I go into it, I wanted to make a link. I'm hoping to show you the link between these three things, trade, investment, and taxation linkage. The fundamental linkage is that they all impact the revenue of developing countries, potential for loss or increase. With the financial crisis, we've seen more loss than increase. They all impact the domestic resource mobilization ability of developing countries. And they all impact the fiscal capacity of developing countries to be able to implement employment guarantees, as we've spoken around here, and employment generating programs. Both of them, I think all three of them in my mind, are race issues about global public good and international regulatory standards. And all three of them, I think, unless there are particular things put in place, are leading a race to the bottom. If you look at the trade, tax, and investment myth, all of them suggest that the market was the best way. There was no need to regulate the market and generate within developing countries kind of a, what I think it's Martin Kaur or Yash Tandon call a pervasive apprehensiveness by developing countries to regulate these areas, so that they dilute the roles of other economic actors in the development process, including women, including small enterprise inside the developing countries. Financial liberal foreign direct investment is privileged over the, as the engine of growth, and so is trade liberalization. There and tax, which should be an important source of development, also became a detraction from development issues. So you find that by the end of the day, you have three sources of activity in the global economy, all of them with a negative trend, negative impact towards fiscal space and the possibility of expansion of fiscal spending. So I want to make a few summary remarks and then just go right into it. Let me look at investment very quickly for everyone. I think if you look at trade, investment, and tax, trade and investment specifically, they both impact the balance of payment, imposing a financing constraint on the domestic economy. The foreign direct investment, to the extent that it requires outflow of funds. I don't have time to go into it, and I wish I did, but if you look at the investment liberalization, which has occurred in terms of three forms, bilateral investment treaties, free trade agreements, and double taxation treaties, you will see that the core elements of the BITs, as we call them, basically focus on, one, a commitment by the state to reduction of performance requirement, to no prohibition on capital control. So even if, in the current context, the IMF was to allow states to impose to free up their balance of payment, many of our governments have signed bilateral investment agreement that have prohibitions limiting them from capital controls and from requirements that may impact the economy in positive ways. So that you find that the other provision is a commitment to investor-state dispute settlement, which is that you go directly to the international arbitration. There's no stopping at the domestic courts. And so currently, there's over 300 investor-state, the right of investors to sue state. Argentina, being the classical example, it now has 30 cases lodged against it as a result of its attempt to deal with its own economic crisis by changing agreements with investment side. And so I really think it might be worth your while to just take a look at some of these investor state prohibition. I'll quickly go to taxation since I have two minutes left. I think the important thing with taxation is that taxation has tremendous implications for poverty eradication. The number of the issues here have to do with tax evasion, and here I'm talking about tax cooperation, which is cross-border tax cooperation. We have the issue of tax evasion, tax compliance, tax competition. And since I don't have time, I'll flag tax competition, something we need to watch. But because in the context of declining foreign direct investment, more of our governments are going to be doing lots of competition to get the scarce foreign investment, which means offering tax inducement and attractive tax attraction to encourage foreign direct investment to stay or to come, which means that money that should be going to social sector and employment generation will be compromised. Tax evasion, huge source of withdrawal of funds. For example, let me give you an example. In data shows Argentina, in 5 years, seven companies in Argentina created revenue of over $22 billion. They paid less than $2 million taxes. Okay? Much of that was due to transfer pricing, tax evasion, and various sorts of issues. So the ability of government to now generate revenue by focusing on increasing the taxation through multinational will be greatly impacted by whatever kinds of international tax cooperation activities is generated through the process of the G20 and the G8. The current bias towards international taxation cooperation is to say, let's focus on exchanging information, and I'm sure that's a zero, on exchanging information. However, civil society groups and many developing countries are arguing that international tax cooperation needs to go beyond transparency. It needs to tackle issues of transfer pricing and tax evasion, and there are many of us who feel that the IMF process, the IMF, in fact, should be reformed so that there's a separation between IMF lending. In fact, IMF should not be in development financing or in trade policy, but that it should retain its supervisory position of the macroeconomic policy, including tracking and tracing tax evasion and tax haven work, and that the UN Tax Committee should be upgraded to an intergovernmental agency similar to the status of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so there are various mechanisms and various proposals around that. I don't have time to go to others, but I'll just flag a couple of the solutions that are being proposed. Of course, currency tax, the Tobin tax by many developing countries, more coordinating among developing countries. Only in Latin America, only about three countries, Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico, actually have detailed discussion about transfer pricing and tax haven in their tax laws. Many developing countries find it very complicated, very complex, and very time-consuming, which is the reason why we need international tax cooperation agreement. There is a set of proposals about civil society which responds to the crisis in terms of moratorium or outright cancellation of debt that's owed to official creditors, especially for countries that are in distress, and that they shouldn't have to pay the interest charges on those kinds of processes, in addition to allocation, a one-time permanent allocation of SDRs for countries in extreme distress, and that the IMF should finance that out of gold sales and other kinds of, in terms of the interest payment on those charges. One more, if you will permit me. Basically, I think, I'm rushing through this really quickly, but basically, for me, the question is whether or not there's a space for actual reform of the IFIs in a way that move them to a trajectory of real anti-poverty and gender equality, which means allowing countries a space to be able to have the kinds of trade policies that we've been discussing here. I think in terms of GEM, I would like to suggest that there is a process of assessing the IMF and the World Bank in terms of governance. I'm going to throw this out and leave it. There's a process of ongoing of assessing the IMF and the World Bank in terms of governance. But what has never been articulated, and something I think we should, as a GEM, articulate, is for a process of a global assessment of the macroeconomic policy and the developmental impact of the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO. That's not been articulated and done, and I think that is something that we need to do to break this unwinding and this locking of development.
Thank you. Thank you very much.